I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In a discouraged democracy facing disruption, both of our frontrunners, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, under a cliff of negative ratings, the historically minded remember Weimar, the worst case. Weimar Germany was the 12-year space after the Kaiser fell under a World War defeat, when the great stars of modernism came out in Berlin, Einstein to Heidegger, Thomas Mann to Oswald Spengler, the poet Rilke to the showman Brecht and Weill, to the movie maker Fritz Lang, who gave us this music in Metropolis. It was a time when popular politics got a vigorous test and then collapsed or surrendered in the rise of National Socialism and Adolf Hitler. Weimar marked a moment when homosexuals, Jews, and women were welcomed into public life. Also when communist and fascist gangs fought it out in the street. Berlin in the 1920s was a world capital of thinking, drinking, and something like Civil War II, as the Englishman Christopher Isherwood observed. In the middle of a crowded street, he wrote in one of his novels, a young man could be attacked, stripped, thrashed, and left bleeding on the pavement. In 15 seconds, it was all over, and the assailants had disappeared. What we learn from history, as everybody knows, is that we don't learn from history. Also, that it never really repeats itself. So why, then, does the question recur in our topsy-turvy 2016? The question, have we entered our all-American Weimar period? Are the stakes even bigger than we imagined? This is the historian's hour to draw observations and questions, not answers, out of the past. Allison Frank Johnson at Harvard and Peter Fritschi at the University of Illinois are with us live. We begin with a montage of historical Weimar and Professor Paul Bookbinder at the University of Massachusetts in Boston.
The Weimar Republic was born out of a period of incredible trauma for the German people. They had just lost the war that they all had expected they would win, and as a result of censorship, they had no idea how badly things had gone for them in the last years of that war. Hmm. And with a country of 60 million people, they had lost 2 million young men dead, and 4 million were wounded. Of that 4 million, about 2 million were so seriously affected, either physically or, as we would say today, by what they called shell shock and we would call post-traumatic stress, that they would never fully integrate into this new German society. Their traditional form of government was no longer. They had lost their Kaiser. They had lost the system of government that they knew, and suddenly they were emerging on this experiment of having a republic and having a democracy in which the voters would really make a difference and political parties would have real power and influence. They would experience the worst inflation that the Western world had ever experienced. Many people, particularly in the middle classes and people on salaries and pensions, would find themselves reduced to very dire economic circumstances. All of this was going to create a great deal of anger. And the new people who were running the Weimar Republic, many of whom were social democrats, a number of whom were new to such positions of power and influence, would be seen by many of the German people as responsible for their defeat in the war, which they were not, and responsible for a peace treaty, which all Germans felt was grossly unfair. You know, emerging from this war, in addition to lots of disabled veterans, an inflation, and a lot of anger and bitterness, was a wonderful spirit of freedom and creativity. Berlin was a wonderfully creative, wonderfully open society. And for the first time, there was a vibrant gay culture. women were a much more significant part of public society in Weimar. For the first time, they could vote, and not only could they vote, but they represented the majority of the electorate.
10:10 werd ich vor deiner Haustür stehen, auf dich warten und vor Schmerz vergehen, wenn du das versäumst.
This is Berlin, it's Cabaret City. I mean, familiar to American moviegoers in some depth. There's a spirit about it.
Absolutely. This was a Berlin that was alive. It was a Berlin that was incredibly exciting to be within. It was a diverse community. And certainly from the film Cabaret, you get a strong sense of this. Christopher Isherwood, who is English-born and raised and would later play a significant part in American culture and particularly American gay culture, went to Berlin and found that he could live as he couldn't imagine that he could have lived anywhere else. Berlin becomes the film capital of the world during the 1920s, and many of the most creative people in Germany at that time would, once the Nazis came to power, find their way to the United States and contribute mightily to American film, to American painting, to American architecture.
The Hollywood names are just staggering. Marlene Dietrich, Billy Wilder, Fritz Lang, so many more. But the burgeoning of big-time names that become universal.
I think I would cast it this way. If you walk down the Kurfürstendamm in Berlin, you might indeed encounter Albert Einstein. And you might encounter Albert Einstein on his way to one of the synagogues in Berlin where he was going to play his violin. And you might encounter, certainly, Marlene Dietrich and her co-star Emil Jannings. And while they might be walking together, their paths were going to incredibly diverge as he would become a prominent Nazi and she would become a prominent anti-Nazi.
Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
And you might indeed even encounter many of the people from the Bauhaus looking at the traditional German architecture and thinking about ways in which they could modernize their city. And going into the cabarets, you would hear the music of the cabaret composers, and many of, like, Friedrich Hollander, for one, who would produce the music for Blue Angel. Mm. It was just a time of incredible vibrance and excitement.
I can't help it.
And, you know, one of the other things, as we walked around the streets of Berlin, we would see young people on the streets, often young men, in political rallies and often in combat with one another. Many of these young people were desperate for idealism, and they looked at Weimar culture as too materialistic. And thus, they were very susceptible to a group that would come along and promise dramatic change. Someone like Adolf Hitler, who could appeal to emotion, who could appeal to idealism, to restore Germany's greatness, and once again give it a place in the sun.
How did Hitler want us to regard Weimar? And how, all told, should we look back on the whole experiment?
Well, I think Hitler wanted the Germans to view Weimar as emerging from a stab in the back, which led to Germany's defeat, that it see it as a form of government imposed from the outside and not true to German traditions, see it as a society which unleashed corrupt and degenerate forces where Jews, he said, played a disproportionate role, where gays were a visible part of Berlin society and German society, where women had lost their true place as mothers and involved in family, and that it was a society where artists were doing work that he considered degenerate, and that Germany had lost its way and needed to both return to more traditional values and yet to have a revolution in terms of creating a racially harmonious and homogeneous society, which would lead it to become the dominant power in the world.
Mm. How should we think about all of Weimar?
Well, I think we should applaud the openness, the inclusiveness, the creativity, realize how we have benefited from all of that. But be aware of the fact that if the institutions in a society, be they judicial, clerical, educational, do not promote democratic values, do not work towards inclusiveness, there is danger.
That was Paul Buchbinder at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. His book on Weimar Germany is subtitled The Republic of the Reasonable. He reminded us of a scene in the American movie musical Cabaret from the 1970s. A young blonde German man is charming an outdoor audience with his song of hope. The camera pans down to the swastika on his armband. Coming up, more of the questions that historians ask looking at us from Weimar about the burdens of war, joblessness, breakpoints in the spirit of a nation. This is Open Source. The Weimar Republic was the name of Germany's first democracy in the sorry wake of World War I. In a culture of liberated geniuses, Weimar was a school, a gamble, an experiment in social welfare politics, and it failed utterly in the collapse of the German economy and the rise of the Hitler madness in the 1930s. It's a nightmare and a warning that never goes away. Peter Fritschi at the University of Illinois, Alison Frank Johnson at Harvard across our river, you are both modern European historians who get this question all the time these days, I'm sure. Are we in sight of Weimar yet? Could it happen here? Is it a stupid question or a self-fulfilling question? Can you identify three symptoms that we ought to worry hard about? Alison, you're first up. Where do you begin your answer to people?
I would have to begin the answer by reminding them that it's a very powerful question, that already by suggesting it's a legitimate question, we're inviting comparisons with Adolf Hitler, who's not only the charismatic leader of a rogue political party, a catch-all party for the of protest for people very fearful, but also ultimately the architect of the Holocaust. So we have to be careful that conversations about Weimar, the Weimar Republic, often have lurking behind them conversations about the Second World War, about wars of extermination, wars of conquest, about the murder of millions and millions of people. So these are not casual comparisons.
No, let's be real. Donald Trump is lurking out there too. Yeah. But at the same time, this common subject is these modern, very sophisticated, very mediated, but angry democracies on the brink of something.
Yes. And we definitely see in the Weimar Republic things that feel resonant to us today. You said yourself a few moments ago, history doesn't repeat itself, and we certainly aren't going to have a repetition of the specific circumstances of Europe in the interwar period. But we do have a period where there are a lot of people feeling a tremendous amount of anxiety. And we see that very clearly in the Weimar Republic, people who feel very uncertain about the foundational economic circumstances of their lives, who feel very uncertain about the rapid cultural changes that we just heard from Professor Buchbinder, who's describing women with their bobbed hair and their short skirts dancing in cabarets, not at home, having babies. Berlin has the lowest birth rate in all of Germany, the highest divorce rate in all of Germany, and it is the site of this cultural excitement that we were just celebrating. Not exciting for some people in Germany to see those kinds of changes. So we can see cultural tension, economic anxiety, political fracturing, extremism. We see all of that in the Weimar Republic. It's very interesting.
Peter Fritschi in Illinois. Can you see it from here?
Well, I would basically agree with Professor Frank's assessment, but one has to realize that the Nazis didn't think of themselves as Nazis in the way we do, and that they thought themselves on the cusp of the modern. They were, unlike the other parties, much more dynamic and youthful. Hitler's mistress, Eva Braun, also had bobbed hair. And I don't think that anxiety is the full explanation of what's going on. The Germans in the Weimar Republic did not want to go back to the Kaiser. They wanted to have something new. And that is why Hitler and the Nazi movement is part of Weimar experimentalism, has to be put on the same shelf as Bauhaus and Marlene Dietrich.
Interesting. And it is the youth movement, as in that movie Cabaret and the boy singing The Future Belongs to Us. Peter, I wish you'd leap into a thing that fascinates me about the lead time of the crisis in Germany and in our world today. It's a staple argument that the Great Depression, massive unemployment, was what tipped Germany into Hitler. But I want to hear the counter-argument that there's a long, slow burn under this eruption of anger, some deep trauma.
Well, every professor would say that students are vulgar Marxists. That is to say, students explain behavior by short-term economic behavior. If it is in my interest, I will do something. And therefore, we basically try to understand tumultuous events like Nazism, but even the 1980 Reagan event, as a function of economic downturns and economic problems. And we see in Germany the graph of the Great Depression. We see the unemployment lines from 1930 to 1933, and right parallel to that is the Hitler vote. So it's very easy to say, well, this is a crisis phenomena. But there's two big arguments against that. That is to say, Hitler and Nazism have deeper roots. One is that the political crisis and the political conflict in Germany has roots that go much earlier than the Great Depression. Small towns, neighborhoods, villages were mobilized politically, very, very conscious. Many, many nationalists voting against the Republic and organizing against it long before Hitler comes to the scene. The second argument against the crisis argument is that if you have a crisis, as Professor Frank said, protest voting, you would imagine that people would be voting across the board. They would be voting for many different parties. There wouldn't be a pattern and coherence in their voting behavior. They would be desperate. But we don't see that. Between 1930 and 1933, people who moved from one party to the other moved in only one of two directions. For working-class Germans, they moved from the socialists to the communists. And much more dramatically, for middle-class Germans, they moved from their traditional liberal and conservative parties to the Nazis. There's not evidence of protest voting. There's evidence of a coherent fundamental movement to the Nazis between 1930 and 1933. So I don't think it's protest voting. I don't think it's anxiety. I don't think it's desperation. It is a culmination of a long-term nationalist revolution in Germany.
I wish you'd apply that logic, Peter, and you too, Allison, to ourselves in this moment. I don't think Donald Trump is not the crisis. Donald Trump is the reader of some very deep anger, misfit trauma in our world. Do you know what I'm saying? Peter, does that make sense to you? That we're, in our country, too, we're talking about something much deeper than the moment.
Well, I think there's been 40 years of the crisis. Newspapers talk about there's been 10 years, 20 years of flatline incomes. It's been 40 years. There has been, I think that there's a sense of betrayal of the Republican, by the Republican Party, that they talk populist, but they talk Wall, Main Street, act Wall Street. And Trump is not the culmination of the Republican Party, but is a reaction to it. It's finally come true. The hypocrisy is now understood. I think it. I think this has been a long time coming. There's also been, and we've seen this since the 1968 elections. There's been a racial divide in this country. The South flipped from Democratic to Republican, but the Confederacy is in the North as well, and people are angry. The difference with Weimar is, I think, that the National Socialist movement was much more positive and insurgent. Was younger. Trump's appeal, I think, is much more defensive and anxious-ridden.
Allison, your turn, but we're talking, as he says, 40 years of an economic trend we don't like, 50 years of a national security state that doesn't know which wars to get into or much less how to win them, and there's underlying all of it a racist pattern in our history that's recurrent, but nothing new. Factor those into the picture of where we're at.
Well, certainly an issue that would have felt pressing, I think, in the interwar period in both Germany and neighboring Austria would be who has the right to call himself or herself German? What does it mean to be a German? Is it a cultural category? Is it a linguistic category? Is it a political category? Is it a racial category? And those questions and the different ways in which they were answered go back not just before 1930 to the First World War, but before the First World War into both the Habsburg Empire and the German Empire, which were both multinational states with lots of people who didn't speak German in them.
In both cases, then and now, this incredible fix on the other in a moment of crisis is startling. Power pictures itself as innocence betrayed by Jews in Hitler speak, but astonishingly, in this country, Donald Trump pictures us as victims of Mexicans, of Chinese, of Muslims.
Yeah.
How do we explain this, Peter, when we just know, all of us know, it just ain't so?
I think it's a very insightful statement to think of one, think of the American people as innocence betrayed. And one of the startling things about German politics in the 1920s, and I think is a parallel right now, it's not only a question of left-right. It's not a question of the Democrats versus the Republicans, red versus blue. It's a question of where's the real America and what has become of the real America. And when you start thinking in those terms, just as Professor Frank said, who's really American? And who doesn't really count? Who's an interloper? Who's just arrived? Who doesn't count? This is a rhetoric that is gaining traction. And it's a surface depth rhetoric. It means that the real America is somewhere else. It's not in Brooklyn. It's not in the Beltway. It's somewhere else. The vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin said it was in Wasilla, Alaska. This is that's the homeland. And insofar as that finds traction, I think there is a parallel. There's a real America and there's not a real America. I just want to just say one thing.
Please.
We know that Trump has huge negatives. So did Hitler. Hitler created a huge people's movement, lots of Catholics, even working class votes, as well as middle class base. But until 1933, there were a lot of people who didn't vote for him. But nonetheless, he created a rhetoric of unity and this us-them idea became increasingly plausible.
How do you turn tremendously high negatives into a lever? I mean, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump would both love to know because they're historically unpopular as final candidates.
Well,
in economics, that's what Hitler did.
I think it's certainly, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor Fritzsche, but and please also call me Allison. I think it helps if there's someone else that people hate more. If there's someone else you can convince people to fear more or to worry about more. And I think it's fair to say that one of the unifying factors for people in Germany who weren't voting for the communists or the socialists is that they were very afraid of communists and socialists, and they were very afraid of Russia. And the words Russian terrorist and socialist could be used interchangeably for those people, as for some of those people at least, as well as the word Judeo-Bolshevik, which is a complete nonsense word that was created by propagandists to imply that being a Bolshevik, being a property-destroying, war-causing, violence-loving communist was the same as being a Jew, and that to protect oneself from the terror of the terrorists coming from the East, one had to protect oneself also from Jews. That wasn't the only kind of Jew that people were afraid of. But
I think that's exactly right. And people, one can argue about how important this was in actual numbers, but people had the sense that they were being invaded in the 1920s by a Jewish immigration. You know this far better than I, but, Vienna was a city that had a very small Jewish population in the 1870s and a very large one in the 1920s, and that was based on immigration from the East. And what's also extraordinary, just as you said, is that people lumped constitutional, real Democrats, really the only Democratic Party in Germany, the Social Democrats, let's call them socialists, with the communists. As far as the non-socialists were concerned, they were all the same. They were Reds. They were proletarians. They wouldn't hire a maid who was a social democrat. And the best example of this is the Jewish diarist, Victor Klemperer, who saw things very clearly, a man of the Enlightenment. He would never, never have voted social democratic, and he did not. In the last free elections or semi-free elections, on the 5th of March, 1933, he threw his vote away. He could not bring himself to vote for the only Democratic Party in Germany. And that is a testimony to this huge split between socialists and non-socialists and not being able to make differentiations. And what strikes me now is everyone thinks Cruz is terrible. Everyone thinks Trump is terrible on the Republican
exactly.
side. But they're going to vote for Hillary. They're not going to vote for Hillary. Anything but.
I was just going to ask, do we understand to this day why the center and left in Germany in the 20s didn't conspire, make common cause against Hitler? Paul Buchbinder was saying it was partly because the communists thought, no, Hitler will burn out in a matter of months or years early, and we're next. It'll be ours.
They were not conspiring before they cared a whit about Hitler. They were not conspiring when other conservatives, not Hitler, the Kapp Putsch in 1920, there was an attempt to overthrow the new constitutional government, establish a right-wing government. The Social Democrats who, as we've just heard, were the party that represented the Constitution and the Republic, were able to put down the revolt in the one of the main industrial sections of Germany, far to the west near the border of France. Communists, workers, took control and they said, "We're it's not enough for us to stop the right-wing putsch. We want to go further." And the socialists sent the army to go put down the left-wing protesters. And Hitler wasn't even part of that picture at all. He was a nobody.
Peter Fritscher.
The main thing for the conservative politicians who were actually running the country without a popular mandate was to keep the Social Democrats out.
That's right.
And the last thing they did before they facilitated the appointment of Hitler was to destroy a democratic government in Prussia. Prussia is three-fifths of Germany. It's Texas, California, New York, plus combined. My grandfather was among the those fired and sent home. And that they did on July 20th, 1932. They did. Their enemy was the Social Democrats. It was not the Nazis. They wanted to somehow rein in the Nazis, mobilize them, use them. But
did you know, Grandpa?
The main enemy was the Social Democrats. It was a completely myopic view. I talked to diplomats to this who to this day they know exactly where their grandfather stood. They don't apologize for them. They're willing to work with Social Democrats today. But back then, Social Democrats were red.
Paul Fritscher, I want to hear more about your grandpa and what you asked him, what he said. We're talking about Weimar Germany, imagining Weimar America. Weimar Germany may be a lost world. Its writers and its thinkers left us enough lessons for a lifetime about modernity, about technology, as well as politics. This is Open Source. Note how Weimar Germany stays alive in our own everyday. Wes Anderson's most recent film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. Also, Amazon's artistic hit show, Transparent. Both use a Weimar backdrop to play on our own nostalgia for tolerance and beauty in a fragile democracy. And then, by contrast, the shouted taunts of communist and fascist that washed out a Trump arena show in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. On campuses, too, Weimar thinkers like Walter Benjamin are top of mind again. I spoke to Eric Jarezinski, the itinerant intellectual and Germanist behind Twitter's Nine Quarterly, about the way in which Weimar thinking speaks to this present moment.
What always interested me about the study of Weimar, about that period, is primarily that this was a period that was so much defined by tensions, by uncertainty, by a certain narrative of modernity, progress, development, liberation of some sort through technology, but also a society where it became very clear just how ambivalent all those developments are and how many costs they have at the same time. I mean, someone like a Walter Benjamin, very interested in these technologies, film, for instance, but they were always asking the question, what are the political stakes of those developments? And in some ways, there's a lot of nostalgia associated with the Weimar Republic. It's often romanticized, glorified. It has a sort of sexy image. But at the same time, this is a time really of tremendous dislocation in terms of rapid urbanization, many of which, you know, we associate with the great renaissance of German modern culture. But at the same time, it's associated with the kind of loneliness and isolation and alienation that in some ways feeds into the kind of political catastrophe that comes at the end of the Weimar Republic. Largely what the thinkers that I'm most interested in would have us call our attention to, say, the staging of political spectacle. That's something which the Trump campaign has been very much been about, but all of American politics and modern politics in general has been about. I mean, there are a great deal of comparisons that one is tempted to make, say, between, always Hitler is brought up as the comparison in so many different leaders over time. And in a way, that comparison doesn't make any sense often when you get down to particularities, but it does make sense in the sense of having a political regime that used the technologies at its disposal very effectively. This is one of the things that has made Western Europe very nervous about American politics in general for a long time. The significance of sort of celebrity political culture, television being so significant, the focus on personality rather than party. What I take most from Weimar is a period that saw such rapid change and upheaval is open to the idea that the status quo is not the way things have to be. But what that means is that things can always get better. It can also mean that things can get much, much worse. Mm. Anything is possible, and that's the bad news. There is, in fact, a sense that comes from that period of there being the possibility for radical change rather quickly that is extremely hard to anticipate. Even the brightest minds of Weimar underestimated the possibility for Hitler to rise to power and then to stay in power that long. You take someone like a Bertolt Brecht, who I greatly admire as someone with a very keen mind for analyzing a political situation, for devising a mode of theater that was very political engaged and so on. You see him when Hitler comes to power, kind of reflecting exactly the kind of sense of judgment of this isn't possible, this cannot last that long, etc. And in fact, realizing that they completely underestimated the power of something like National Socialism. So I would say the other thing is that the notion of modernity that comes from someone like a Thomas Mann or others, like in his Magic Mountain, modernity comes down to a process of getting used to not getting used to things. And also the urgent necessity of becoming involved in changing one's society, where one feels that society needs to be changed, but also never being very assured of the fact that what you're doing is going to accomplish that or that it's going to have the desired outcome in any way, but the necessity of doing something anyway.
That was Eric Jaruzinski, who left the Academy to tweet at Nine Quarterly, he calls it. He is taking his philosophical show on the road this summer. Our guests are Alison Frank Johnson of Harvard in our studio, Peter Fritschi of the University of Illinois on the phone. Peter, would you just talk back on this matter of modernity? The minds of Weimar saw it a lot more clearly, I think, than we do. Loneliness, alienation, all the symptoms
totally
being worse in our world today, our ever more urban world.
They got it totally wrong. I mean, you look at Brecht and Grosch and all the artists and playwrights and philosophers, they got it totally wrong. They thought this was some sort of last stand of capitalism. George Grosch's paintings talk about the five pillars of society, the establishment with the scars, dueling scar on the face. This is not what the Nazis were about. They were against those people. This was an insurgent, young, dynamic movement. And the Weimar geniuses that we pay tribute to got it sociologically completely wrong. They never understood Nazism. The Germans weren't
lonely.
But
what about modernity?
The Germans weren't lonely. They were going home. With the Nazis. They were creating a new home, or a refurbished home, I would say. In terms of modernity, the Nazis completely understood that it was a dangerous world. That's why they did racial selection. That's why they did sterilization. That's why they did preemptive war. They were fully capable of understanding the dangers of the world. In fact, they overdramatized them. In the most horrendous way, they created a justification for preemptive war against their own people and against other people, precisely because the world was dangerous. They understood modernity very well, in their view, I don't think they were lonely. These people had created clubs, they had created movements, they were on the streets, and they'd been on the streets for 10 years, long before the Nazis came.
Alison Frank Johnson, I mean, is that fair to the way they speak to us today about alienation?
One of the words that struck me in the bit we just heard from
Peter,
from Eric, was nostalgia.
Yes.
And the way that we can assume that the expressions of nostalgia come with a desire to reject the modern. And I think that what we've just heard from Peter Fritzsche is an extremely important corrective to that. Some of the most important modernist authors of this interwar period, and I'll give you a few Austrian examples. You already mentioned Stefan Zweig, Robert Musil, who wrote The Man Without Qualities, which is this giant 20th century novel, Joseph Roth, who wrote The Radetzky March. These are all stories that are set in the pre-war period in the Habsburg monarchy. Zweig's, one of his memoirs called The World of Yesterday.
We're going to get to that.
And it is, the first chapter is called The World of Security.
Yes, the age.
He misses this world of security. And it is terribly anxiety-provoking to live in a world without any security. But he has no desire to go back to the past. It's a nostalgia for a world that people felt they could understand, but not coupled with a desire to go backwards. One can only go forwards.
We'll come back to Zweig. I want to touch on matters of media, with which the Weimar intellectuals were completely fascinated. Mm. The philosopher Siegfried Krakauer made a big deal of cabaret as medium and message. I mean, literally, the high-kicking dancing girls related to the Nazi masses marching at Nuremberg in the famous rallies. Do you want to take a piece of that, Peter? Let me cut to the chase with the question. What would Walter Benjamin and his intense rumination on modern media, what would he make of Twitter? What combination, what connection would he want to make between not just this kind of universal commentary buzzing round the clock all the time, but a candidate, with 7 million subscribers ready for instant news, instant anything on Twitter?
Well, what's very interesting, if you look at the circulation of the newspapers in Germany, the democratic newspapers were way ahead of the Nazi newspapers, well through 1932 and 1933. The mass circulation press was like television. We're watching ourselves. They had feuilleton pieces about this and that and discussed all the tumultuous things in the world. It was news is entertainment. But these newspapers, their editorial line was left. Hmm. But no one followed them. They read them, but they didn't follow them. I think that there is a huge disconnect between looking at the media of Weimar and understanding the voter dynamics that are going on since 1924 that lead into Hitler's tremendous breakthrough in 1930 and then on to 1933. And that, I think, is really interesting. I don't think that Hitler, sure, he was a celebrity, but he was seen as a honest man in his trial for treason in 1924, and he got a lot of press for that, and he came across as an everyman. He didn't dress up in the uniforms of the old state as his co-defendants did, and people said he was an honest man, and he's us.
A different way to answer that question.
I haven't heard the answer to on Benjamin and Twitter, but go ahead.
Well, I'll give that a little bit of a try in pointing out that one of the things that distinguishes the 19th century newspaper is its ability to print pages and pages and pages of political speeches given in Parliament, entire speeches printed word for word, the whole thing, and people would read them. In the 20th century, we find the development of the aphorism. I suspect Walter Benjamin would love Nine Quarterly. I'm not sure he would love some of the political tweets that we see and the immediate audience that they get. But the idea of expressing ideas in a very short period of time was something that some of our modernist authors, Peter Altenberg very famously, Karl Kraus.
I was going to say Karl Kraus.
Yeah.
The Oscar Wilde of Vienna.
Yes.
Cleverest man in history.
And loved quips. He loved... Can he say something in 14 words to astonish you?
Try this. Psychoanalysis is the disease that presumes to call itself the cure.
Yes, that's a very good example.
Or the observation that the difference between the Berlin outlook and the Vienna outlook. In Berlin, the situation is always serious but not desperate. in Vienna, the situation is always desperate, but not serious.
Another perfect example. And this was an art form of the early 20th century, an art form of this Weimar era that we now see returning in a different way. And that may be why a Germanist loves it so much.
I want to bring you both back to the book you mentioned, Allison. For me, far the most affecting book on the Weimar period, although it's in Vienna, not Berlin. It's the Stefan Zweig World of Yesterday, a memoir from the man who knew Freud, who knew Karl Kraus, he knew Richard Strauss, he knew Joseph Roth, he knew absolutely everybody, and who saw his Vienna world as the all-time pinnacle of spiritual life, sort of the way Victor Hugo saw the French Revolution. But then, in an instant, it's gone as a sort of opium dream. He flees to New York and then to Rio. He writes without any notes. He writes his whole memoir, The World of Yesterday, sends it to his publisher, and then the next day kills himself with his wife. An absolutely crushing parable of the whole thing, which leaves every reader with this sense of the fragility of absolutely everything. How do you read it, and how do we make a lesson out of Stefan Zweig?
Stefan Zweig, that phrase that you used, without any notes, is more powerful than I think some of your listeners will know. This man was a bibliophile. He loved books. He loved collecting. Mm. He piled symbols of the beauty of European civilization all around him in his home, and he left all of that. So writing without notes means writing without manuscripts, writing without books, writing without pieces of paper that had been touched by Mozart. Mm. He was the most widely translated author in the world in the 1920s at one point, and he made an early career translating. And for him, the Europe that he loved was a Europe that he imagined to be without borders, a Europe of intellectuals who didn't care about passports, a Europe where French poets and German poets and Austrian poets loved translation because they loved reading one another. Mm. And that world was already gone for him in the Weimar period, long before Hitler rose to power, in a period of passports and small nation states and borders, borders, borders. He was very sorry to see it go. But as we heard again in Eric's remarks, if things can get better, they can get much, much worse. Mm. And what he saw happen when he lived in Salzburg, right on the border with Germany, and was had to leave Austria very quickly when the Nazis came in. It's an extremely poignant story of loss. But I guess I would want, as tempting as it is to end with Zweig, perhaps to remember something said by Thomas Mann as well, which is that even a story with a sorry ending has its moments of beauty, great and small. So we don't want to let Weimar only be defined by its ultimate collapse and failure.
Peter Fritzsche, can you embrace Stefan Zweig or top him?
Thomas Mann and Stefan Zweig were basically novelists who were reconcilatory. I mean, they brought the opposite somehow back together. The great shock for them was that that did not happen. You had this rupture, a murderous rupture. And Stefan Zweig wrote his memoirs in Petropolis, Brazil, in the shadow of his own suicide in 1941. Mm. But it's important to realize that the effects of Hitler are different from why he came to power. Nobody voted for the Holocaust. Nobody voted for World War II. That's the last thing the Germans wanted, was what they got after 1939. And that's, in fact, why they blame Hitler for destroying the Third Reich, which they loved. They didn't want war and Holocaust. So the trauma in which Zweig writes is what the Nazis ended up doing. But that is very different from why the Nazis came to power. It's not completely different. I mean, there's the other, and Allison has spoken about the huge suspicion about internal enemies. That's all extremely important, but people did not vote in 1932 for the Holocaust, and they certainly did not vote for World War II.
Paul Fritzsche, this is where we have to take our leave. Thank you Thank you, Alison Frank Johnson. Thanks also to Paul Bookbinder, Eric Jarodzinski, too. Thanks to George Prochnik and Eric Weitz. We're going out with Metamorphosen, Richard Strauss's study for 23 strings, composed in the closing months of World War II. Consider it his elegy for Weimar. This month, our show is featured on the Stitcher platform for podcasts. Welcome to the new listeners. Get in touch anytime on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Open Source. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.